March 7th included state testimony arguing that it would be risky to change the definition of marriage, citing studies claiming that children raised by same-sex couples had worse outcomes in life. Scholars called to rebut the testimony described a virtual consensus in the field that, with other factors like income and stability being considered, children fared just as well with same-sex parents. The unusually extensive trial record could strengthen Judge Friedman's ruling in the appeals process and could prove useful elsewhere as similar challenges to marriage restrictions enter state and federal courts. Since June, when the United States Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, federal judges in Utah, Oklahoma, Virginia, Texas, and now Michigan have declared that state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. The rulings are headed for circuit courts of appeal in coming months, putting pressure on the Supreme Court to revisit the issue. And now we return to the report released this week by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, finding that a number of Oregon corporations have managed to avoid paying income taxes.
Would you like to explain your report?
We've looked at a national report that showed how much corporations were paying in state income taxes nationwide. And we also looked at some state numbers from the Oregon Department of Revenue to see how much our corporations were paying in corporate income taxes here in Oregon. And what we found was that there were at least 24 corporations that made a profit in Oregon in 2011 that paid no Oregon income taxes for that year. And that included eight corporations that had profits of over $5 million each in that year.
How did that compare with other states?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know. We don't have a good grasp on how much corporations pay in state taxes to any individual state. They're required to file with the federal government how much they pay in total to all states in the form of income taxes. But we don't know. We don't have a good grasp of how much any individual corporation pays to any individual state in the form of corporate income taxes.
So how much would you say Oregon lost as far as income tax with relation to corporations paying not even the minimum?
So in 2011, there were a total of just over 90 corporations that used tax credit to pay less than the corporate minimum tax. And in total, those 90 plus corporations reduced their tax liability by over $3 million.
Are there other things that could be done to help improve payments by corporations into the state coffers?
Sure. The first thing that we can do as a state is to close the new loophole that was opened by a recent Supreme Court case that allowed corporations to pay less than the minimum tax. Recently, the trucking company Conway sued so that they could apply a tax credit that they had purchased to reduce their minimum tax bill. And the Supreme Court ruled in their favor last year, which opened up the door for other corporations to do the same thing. So when voters raised the corporate minimum tax in 2010, they wanted every corporation, especially the profitable ones, to pay something to support the common good. Lawmakers should uphold the will of the voters and close the loophole that Conway created last year.
Are you able to discern some of the companies that did not pay any taxes in recent years?
Unfortunately, no, we can't. We know that from the court proceedings that Conway reduced their tax liability to $0 in 2009, but since we don't have a strong corporate disclosure law, we don't know the identity of the other 24 profitable Oregon corporations, or of the 24 profitable Oregon corporations that paid zero in state income taxes in 2011.
We have been speaking to Jason Gettle with the Oregon Center for Public Policy.
Where we buy our food and what we eat affects all of us on a daily basis. In the past two decades, a movement to eat more locally and more organically has grown steadily. At the same time, large international corporations dominate the food landscape, often growing crops using pesticides or other chemicals. Now, farmers in Jackson County are hoping to ban genetically modified crops, also known as GMOs. While cost estimates range, County Commissioner Don Skundrick acknowledged that as long as farmers comply with the ban and there are no complaints from the public, there would be no cost to the county. KBOO reporter Ryan Katz has more.
This past year, the Oregon State Legislature passed a measure that prohibits counties in Oregon from regulating genetically modified crops. However, in May, voters in Jackson County will vote on a measure that would ban production of all GMO crops in that county. I spoke with Elise Higley, the director of Our Family Farms Coalition, which is the major group that is supporting the ban on GMOs. Elise says that these large chemical companies come in and plant GMO-based crops, renting land from local growers. However, this puts neighboring plots at risk.
You know, it really puts us at an economic disadvantage to be able to, to be at risk for genetically engineered contamination. There can be a 4-mile contamination spread, 4 miles on either side. Say if somebody's growing corn, a farm 4 miles away can be affected. And not only does it make our crop unsellable, it also puts us at legal risk because then we're now growing something that is patented that we actually didn't pay for. And like so many other farms, throughout the U.S. and the world, we're at risk of, getting a knock on our door saying that, we need to come up with a settlement or have to take these huge corporations to court. There's been thousands and thousands and thousands of settlements that have been happening over the last few years.
In terms of the quality of the crops that Jackson County growers are providing to Oregon and to the world, like you said, what is so harmful about GMOs in general?
I think that is a personal decision on whether people want to have, genetically engineered food to buy. But the reality is that the market really does not want to buy it. And the international market that's already shown the wheat shut down in eastern Oregon.
What you're referring to is that other countries in Asia and Europe are refusing to buy genetically modified wheat.
60 other countries didn't even allow genetically engineered crops. Even Cheerios and Grape Nuts have said they're genetically engineered free. So, this is what the market is saying they want. This is what the people are saying they want to know.
So what does the ballot initiative actually say in terms of prohibition of GMOs and then the enforcement mechanisms that are in place?
You wouldn't be allowed to cultivate, grow genetically engineered crops. Some of these big companies that are leasing land here is mostly what's happening. That's probably, I would say, 90-something percent of what's going on in our county. So they would have a year to finish out those contracts, and then they wouldn't be allowed to renew those the following year. The county has a discretion on how and they want to enforce that, if they want to at all. At least it would prohibit that, that growth. And so if somebody privately wanted to pursue it, if the county didn't, they would be able to do that on their own, and they would be able to take legal action. We've looked at three other counties in the West Coast that have very similar measures than what we have proposed. And the great news is that there has been zero, if minimal, cost. And then also their, agricultural sales have, skyrocketed. I think it's gone 8 times the amount in the last 10 years. So, that's what farmers and people are looking for, is to be a genetically engineered-free zone.
On that issue of cost, opponents of the ballot initiative say that it will be expensive. There was a county estimate from either $0 up to around, I saw, $1.7 million. How do you respond to that?
I mean, basically, it just goes to show you the political games that are going on, the facts are that there's three other counties that have a measure like this in place. We have spoken and have quotes from all of the counties saying that there has been minimal, zero cost. So that's what we can look at. The figures that were pulled from the administrator's report were basically just hypothetical estimates. And so we actually asked for that report and those costs to be retracted and to come up with something that is valid that actually pertains to the counties that have it implemented currently. The likelihood of somebody growing a genetically engineered crop when it's illegal is actually really not very likely. This isn't something that you go down and you can't buy genetically engineered seeds. You have to register with one of these major chemical companies. There's legal contracts that you sign, so you don't accidentally grow a GMO crop. So I really don't, feel like it would be prudent business for these, big chemical companies to be signing legal contracts illegally.
I was speaking with Elise Higley, the director of Our Family Farms Coalition in Jackson County. For KBOO News, this is Ryan Katz.
Fred Phelps, the outspoken leader and founder of the controversial Westboro Baptist Church, died Wednesday night at the age of 84. Phelps and the members of the Westboro Baptist Church were notorious for their violently anti-gay rhetoric. They publicly picketed war veterans' funerals, holding signs claiming the soldiers died because of America's tolerance for homosexuals. Based in Topeka, Kansas, the Westboro Baptist Church has progressively isolated itself under the leadership of Phelps from other far-right evangelical communities by following the religious tradition of primitive Baptists. Many conservative religious groups consider homosexuality to be a sign of the nation's moral decay. But Phelps went beyond that to claim that he was a prophet of America's impending doom and that the religious right is part of the problem. In 2011, the Supreme Court upheld their right to picket at soldiers' funerals by overturning a 2008 ruling against them, citing their constitutional right to free speech. It is unclear who will lead the church following Phelps' death.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny, with a high of 62 degrees. Sunday will see a similar pattern with a high of 66. On this day in 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and 3,000 civil rights activists marched from Selma, Alabama, to the state's capital in Montgomery. Today marks Human Rights Day in South Africa, celebrating the lives of those who died in the fight for democracy during apartheid. And marking its 8th anniversary today is the world's first tweet sent out by Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey. The quote of the day comes from the mother of President Andrew Jackson, Elizabeth Jackson, who told her son before she died, "Andrew, if I should not see you again, I wish you to remember and treasure up some things. In this world, you will have to make your own way. To do that, you must have friends. You can make friends by being honest. You can keep them by being steadfast. You must keep in mind that friends worth having will, in the long run, expect as much from you as they give to you." The time is 5:20. It's time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
You have to ask tough questions on the...
Mark Twain spoke for me when he said, "I'm opposed to millionaires, but it would be dangerous to offer me the position." One danger that such wealth brings is that many who have it become blinded to those who don't. Thus, the news that more than half of our Congress critters are now in the millionaire class helps explain why it has been striving ceaselessly to provide more government giveaways to Wall Street bankers and other super wealthy elites, while also striving to enact government takeaways from middle class and poor families. Take the richest House member, Representative Daryl Issa, with a net worth of $464 million. A right-wing California Republican, he's used his legislative powers to try denying health coverage to poor Americans, even as he tried to unravel the new restraints to keep Wall Street bankers from wrecking our economy again. ISA and his ilk are proof that a lawmaker's net worth is strictly a financial measure, not any indication at all of one's actual value or worthiness. I hasten to note that many millionaires in America have been able to rise above their financial handicap, serving the public interest rather than self or special interests. For example, when Representative Shelley Pingree was elected to Congress in 2009, she was an organic farmer and innkeeper in rural Maine. Definitely not a millionaire, she was a stalwart fighter for such progressive policies as getting corporate money out of politics, enacting Medicare for all, and reining in Wall Street greed. But in 2011, Pingree married, of all people, a Wall Street financier, and was suddenly vaulted into the ranks of the one percenters. So naturally, her legislative positions changed, not one whit. This is Jim Hightower saying, see, even in Congress, being a millionaire is no excuse for becoming a narcissistic jerk. Siding with plutocrats is not an incurable condition, it's a choice.
The National Association of Realtors has released their latest sales figures showing a 7% increase in home sales compared to this time last year. 60% of these homes were classified as cash sales, which means that, for the most part, these homes are being sold to big banks and investment companies, not to families and individuals. Housing experts attribute the recent increase in so-called cash sales to the Federal Reserve's policy of quantitative easing. This policy provided up to $85 billion a month in 2013 to large banks and investors. That number is now down to $65 billion a month, which still represents a massive segment of the public wealth going directly to private investors. 30-year mortgage applications are less than half of what they were 30 years ago, showing the change in home buying away from middle-class homeowners to large banks and investment funds buying the homes as rentals. In some cases, the families that once owned the homes that were foreclosed on end up having to rent back their homes from the large banks, often paying more in rent than they had been paying for their monthly mortgage. The rate of first-time home buying has also continued to fall as a tough job market and high student loan debt have made home ownership unaffordable and out of reach for many people across the U.S.
Fast food workers in New York City have won $500,000 settlement from a McDonald's franchise owner. Richard Cisneros, the owner of 7 McDonald's restaurants, has agreed to reimburse 1,600 current and former employees for labor rights abuses, including wage theft, unpaid overtime, and unpaid laundry stipends. The lawsuit is one of several filed recently against the fast food industry and is seen as a victory for a growing nationwide movement for dignity and higher wages for fast food workers. The movement organized a day of action on Tuesday that saw protesters in 30 states demonstrating against labor abuses at McDonald's and other franchises. The protesters have called for an increase in the federal minimum wage to $15. Currently, the minimum wage stands at $7.85 an hour.
America's largest nuclear waste dump, located in Carlsbad, New Mexico, has admitted to the release of more nuclear radiation. Whistleblowers have reported that a ceiling collapsed at the plant, causing multiple barrels of radioactive waste to rupture. The Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, known by its acronym WIPP or WIP, currently stores high-level nuclear waste from a variety of nuclear sites, including Los Alamos and Hanford. The waste is shipped to New Mexico, where it is stored in hollowed-out salt caverns. Opened in 1999, the designers of the plant said that it was designed to last 10,000 years. It currently stores 80,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste in more than 400,000 barrels. The waste was transported to WIP on over 11,000 truck and railroad car loads. This means that since 1999, nuclear waste has been traveling on public roads and through large metro areas where an accident could have an impact lasting hundreds or thousands of years. In the latest radioactive leak at the Carlsbad facility, safety systems designed to close all vents and ducts and reroute all air through a special filter system failed when the ducts did not close. This means that there was another direct release of radiation into the air around the plant, which is located just 26 miles from the urban center of Carlsbad.
More disturbing news has been emerging this week from the ongoing disaster at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Treatment of highly radioactive water at the plant was indefinitely suspended due to multiple malfunctions. This includes both inadequately filtered water and contamination of previously clean water. Plans call for removal of the nuclear fuel to begin in 6 years at the earliest. The reactor buildings are currently too radioactive for even robots to enter. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, known as TEPCO, admits that they do not know where the molten fuel is, but believe it has not entered the ground below the primary containment vessel. With the heavy onset of radiation exposure, for more experienced employees, TEPCO has begun to use labor brokers to help fill the labor demands. Current reports from multiple sources point to the Japanese mafia, Yakuza, as having extensive ties with the labor brokers and TEPCO. Reports suggest that Yakuza has threatened employees with violence, decreasing morale at the plant. Multiple sources have also reported that upwards of 800 workers have disappeared from the Fukushima nuclear power plant, and health effects on local citizens are beginning to be seen. To date, 75 cases of thyroid cancer have been detected in Fukushima residents, which, based on historical averages, should be less than 5 cases per 100,000.
In the context of extreme smog conditions in places like Paris and Shanghai, the Guardian newspaper reports that the remote mountain nation of Nepal also suffers from a pollution crisis. A 63-year-old resident of Kathmandu named Ajay reports that he is hardly able to breathe, even while using an oxygen mask. Even though he has never smoked, Ajay is dying. He suffers from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, and chronic bronchitis. Like most citizens, Ajay is one of many seeking respiratory help in emergency rooms. Kathmandu is situated in a high-altitude area and is booming with new construction. Local traffic congestion typically causes particulate matter to swell to 20 times the safe upper limit set by the World Health Organization. This industrial activity leaves dust, diesel fumes, and vehicle emissions besieging the capital. In an environmental performance index by Yale University of 178 countries around the world, Nepal's air quality ranks second to last.
The Pentagon said today that it will participate in a long-planned multinational military exercise this summer in Ukraine. Dubbed Rapid Trident, the ground maneuvers have been held annually for a number of years with forces from Britain and other NATO countries, as well as Ukraine. Ukraine has a partner relationship with NATO, but is not a member. Russia also has a partner relation status with NATO, and the U.S. had planned to conduct a military exercise in northeast Russia in July of this year, but this was canceled due to the crisis in Ukraine. In addition to U.S. and U.K. troops, the exercises in the Ukraine this year will include units from several former Soviet republics, along with Germany, Poland, and Romania. The publicly stated reason for the exercise is to help the Ukrainian military improve its troops and weapons operability with NATO forces. But a geopolitical implication that will worry Russia is that Ukraine may become a member of NATO at some point, right on Russia's doorstep. Last year's Rapid Trident was held in July with land forces from 17 countries participating and lasted 2 weeks.
At least 9 civilians, including a journalist and several children, were killed last night in Kabul in a shooting attack on a luxury hotel in Afghanistan. 4 armed teenagers managed to gain entry through 2 security checks at the Serena Hotel and then began shooting hotel guests. The teenagers had pistols hidden in their socks. Among those killed were journalist Sarda Ahmed, who wrote for Agence France-Presse, along with his wife and two of his three young children. No motive has been established for the attack, which followed a shooting attack on Wednesday in Hallebalad, in which 18 people were killed, including the seven attackers. That attack targeted a police station. The two attacks highlight the lack of security in Afghanistan right now, even in areas deemed to be safe by U.S. and coalition forces. They come just weeks ahead of a presidential election in the country on April 5th, in which current President Hamid Karzai will be replaced. The U.S. government favors Ashraf Ghani, an economist with ties to the World Bank. Ghani came in fourth in the 2009 elections. It's hard to know who is ahead in the polls for the April 5th election because the polling methods used have been criticized as inaccurate. Past elections in Afghanistan have faced accusations of vote rigging and corruption. Other leading candidates include Abdullah Abdullah, an eye surgeon with the main opposition party, and Zalmai Rasool, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs under Karzai. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, Carl Vischer, Terry Eaton, Kristen Yost, and David Lange. The producer is Ryan Katz. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on this news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Carl Vischer.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott host More Talk Radio. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist point of view. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with writer Michelle Nyehouse. She's the author of the article, Can Coal Ever Be Clean?, about whether coal can ever be clean. At 11, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. And at 11:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum with part two of an interview with Peter Goodman, child therapist, on the emotional needs that all children have growing up in an increasingly stressful society. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not yet a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the temperatures in the early 60s. And remember to tune in Monday to Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. for our locally produced evening news. Good night, Carl.
Good night, Jenka.
Hi, I'm your host for The Union of Time Thieves, a new radio exploration of urban life. This episode, we will take a look at monuments, what they are, how they affect us, and how we can reclaim them. The Union of Time Thieves will be on the fourth Monday of each month from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.fm under Community Events.
Headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, New York City tabloids are feeding happily off what's been described as a tug of war between Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo over charter schools. But while you can learn something about political alliances and aspirations, what does this coverage teach you about charter schools? We'll speak with Sarah Jaffe from In These Times about deciphering New York's charter battle. Also this week, have you heard the one about how the White House was planning to send government monitors into newsrooms? It was a big story on the right, and the controversy killed the FCC study. But it wasn't about government snooping. The point was to explore questions of media diversity and underserved communities. Carla Murphy of Color Lines will join us to explain. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
What if lawmakers put forward a federal budget plan to tax big financial institutions, enact a healthcare public option, and increase spending to put millions of Americans to work on badly needed infrastructure projects? Well, some of them did just that. You